Penguin Random House Audio presents Daughters of Bronze, A Novel of Troy by A.D. Rhine. Read for you by Vane Asadorian, Hilary Huber, Eva Kaminsky, and Saskia Marleveld.
And Priam and his 50 sons wake all amazed and hear the guns and shake for Troy again. Rupert Brooke. Fragment of a poem written as he approached Cape Helles in 1915. But the effect of her being on those around her was incalculably diffusive. For the growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric acts. And that things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been is half owing to the number who lived faithfully a hidden life and rest in unvisited tombs. George Eliot, Middlemarch. To our husbands, Jordan and Joshua, and to our children, Isla and Jack, Uriah, Isaac, Daniel, and Caleb. You are our everything. The Shade. A sorrow wind that batters walls, a quiet shadow through quiet halls. Who hears the wind and discerns a cry? Who sees the shadow and does not hide? Silent screamer, forgotten dreamer, upon the rocks where bones still lie, now hears the shade a desperate call. The horse of fire pacing his stall, he feels it slither across the moon. A touch of ice, a whispered, soon. Song not yet written, notes rearranged. Choices and fates might still be changed. The shade's red tears leave a little doubt. So many ways in, just one way out.
Book One. 1. Rhea. A cry pierces the night. My bones absorb the jagged note. I press myself flat to the ground as a winged army erupts from the tall grasses all around me. They take to the air above the Lisgar swamp. Birds. 100 feathers blocking out the moon. Only when they melt into the darkness do I see what flies high above their wings. It burns across the night. Head of fire and a tail of flame. Glowing scales of molten color only the gods can name. A serpent in the sky. Half-remembered stories from my childhood rise up in the silence. Pieces of Phrygian prayers and old Hittite songs that spoke of eternal winters. Of sheets of ice that became floods of rain to drown the world. Death and rebirth that left even the mountains scattered as dust upon the wind. A shudder runs through me despite the sticky summer heat. I rise from the grass. This time, the warning is not a sound, but a feeling. Movement to the west. Tall reeds swaying in the opposite direction of the wind. One shadow separates from the others. He is not wearing armor, but the outline of a spear is visible over his shoulder. A mane of long, lank hair tumbles down his back. He stands, staring at the place where the fire serpent lingers on the horizon. I count 227 breaths before the sentry melts back into the shadows of the Scamander Plain. 100 breaths more, and I slip over the hill that overlooks the Achaeans' camp on Sygeum Ridge, where the invaders have been camped the 10 long years of this war. The moon drifts back behind the clouds, drenching the swamp and hidden lattice that forms a secret path across it in darkness. But every one of the steps I take is part of a dance I can perform now with my eyes closed. A hulking monolith takes shape out of the gloom to my right. The stones sing to me with their own beguiling magic, but I force myself to move past the ancient shrine to gods long forgotten without looking back. My basket waits in a clump of bushes just before the latrines. Tucking it under my arm, I step out into the camp and blink against the brightness of 100 fires. On my way to the bathhouse, I pass Agamemnon's settlement. Then Menelaus's. One after another, I list off the names of the Achaean kings until, finally, I draw near the camp closest to the Keswick Cut. The gates outside Odysseus's settlement are barred to outsiders, as they've been since the Ithacans' failed attempt to trap Troy's people behind burning walls last spring. The lower city would have fallen then but for my mistress, Harsa Andromache, wife of Prince Hector, and the mother to Troy's future heir. That day when Odysseus's arrows rained fire, it was Andromache and her allies who saved Troy from destruction. I know because I was there. From my hiding place upon the Trojan plain, I saw everything, even if nobody saw me. A low groan rises from my right, where a swaying Achaean relieves himself against the nearby hut. A short sword glints in the war belt at his waist. I myself carry no weapons but the small blade strapped to my thigh. Despite Andromache's best efforts to teach me, I am no warrior. Nor am I a leader whom others would follow as they do her and Prince Hector. Instead, my talents lie here, in the shadows, where I gather bits of information like straw and bring them back to those who might do something with them. Only, lately there is no straw to be found. I approach Odysseus's settlement. The walls have been built high enough to block out prying eyes. There is only the sound of cracking wood, smelting metal at all hours, and a subtle shift in the air. One that tells me that Odysseus's men are building something behind those gates. Whatever it is, it can only mean trouble for Troy. It is the conviction that brings me back here, night after night. The smell of livestock grows stronger the closer I draw to Odysseus's settlement. A few men stripped down to kilts work just outside the well-constructed gates. Most of the Achaeans deride Odysseus behind his back for these extra precautions he has taken. And why wouldn't they? Since the fighting resumed on the summer moon, the gridlock on the plain remains unbroken. Men bleed and men die, but the lines that mark the spaces between them do not move. Without Achilles and his deadly myrmidons to bolster their ranks, the Achaeans have made no ground. But neither has Prince Hector and his army. In the common places where the men gather after long days on the plain, words have taken the place of spears. The men mock Hector for the same reason they do Odysseus, because they do not glimpse the higher stars that guide them, each along his own path. Hector's refusal to press is born not of weakness, but of duty to a king, a council, and 100 years of tradition that bind his hands. As for Odysseus, unlike the other warriors on Sigeum Ridge, men who drink and quarrel to drown their homesickness and their fatigue, Odysseus knows that danger is much closer than they realize. Even now, it walks among them, waiting upon their tables and lying beside them at night with open eyes while they drift away to sleep. A clump of wet earth lands in my path, drawing me up short. A man lifts himself out of the trench to my right. The young warrior nods in apology. I nod back, storing his face in the memory that uniquely qualifies me for this dangerous role I play. The same memory that assures me that while the Ithacans are here digging day and night, their trench somehow never gets any deeper. I watch them work with calculated laziness. Like the sentry on the plain, their gazes are trained not on the tools in their hands, but on the Keswick Cut. Searching. Waiting. The moist heat of the bathhouse rolls over me. I hardly spare the naked men in the pools a glance as I move toward the back where Ven, my closest ally in this camp full of enemies, and one whose scarred face I had a hand in making, supervises the washing. Her brows draw together as she watches me approach. "What's wrong?" she demands. "Hello to you too." I lay down my basket and bend to help her with a load of dirty tunics. "Never mind that," Ven snaps. "You're white as moonstone. What's happened?" "The serpent in the sky."
"So I heard,"
Ven says grimly.
"The men are agitated. They say Agamemnon's priests are holed up in his hall trying to divine some meaning in it."
She shrugs.
"It is not the first warning sent by the gods, and it will not be the last. If it makes the Achaeans anxious, all the better for us."
I nod,
Sample complete. Ready to continue?